Okay. So, what I'd like you to do is kind of back up. And I know that in our first interview, we talked a lot about the mechanisms of institutional memory within a field. So, for instance, I remember you talking about the ARC, its move, and its becoming the NIDA intramural program. And I want to get to that, but I'd like you to sort of back up and describe your own pathway into addiction research and tell us whether you identify with any particular professional field or discipline within the larger field.
Okay. So I guess my own personal interest in addiction research came, you know, because I was sort of a child of the 60s and was in, you know, involved and knew about a lot of drug use and so forth in the 60s and became interested in wondering how the brain, you know, was able to respond to just small amounts of chemicals and change the whole perception idea. And I got therefore, I was kind of interested in really like a neuroscience or a neurocognitive approach to drug abuse at the very beginning. And I'd read enough of the literature to notice that the Lexington group was one of the very few places that this was being done in a sort of a parametric scientific way, that they had done experiments with opiates at the time and benzodiazepines and alcohol. And there was interest in the hallucinogens, even in the early 60s when Bill Martin was there. And so I was, you know, drawn toward the Lexington group anyway. But as it turned out, the reason I guess I ended up going there was kind of a wrong turn on the road. I was driving my car from my home in Rochester down to graduate school in Tennessee. And when I got to Cincinnati, I think the road could either go to Louisville, which would have been the closer route, or as the turn I took led me to Lexington. I spent the night in Lexington, and I remember thinking, well, gee, I'm in Lexington, why don't I just call the Addiction Research Center, I've read about the place, and just see if I can meet somebody out there. And I called, and Bill Martin was gracious enough to invite me out, and gave me an interview and a tour of the place. This is my second year of graduate school. And he gave me a tour of the place, and I was taken with it.
Graduate school where?
I was at the University of Tennessee in Memphis. And I remember Bill Martin, I was being so impressed and talking to him and, you know, saying, gee, I wish I could get into this. At the time, I was just beginning to define my PhD problem, and I had an advisor that was interested in kidney microtubule puncture, and I said, God, I wish I could do something like this, but there didn't seem to be that much opportunity at Tennessee to do it. Bill Martin said, it doesn't matter what you do. He says, make sure you just do it well. And he was always that kind of a guy, actually. He's very precise and very demanding, actually. But as it turned out, in Tennessee, a position did open up with another professor, Dr. Richard White, who was a neuropharmacologist, I finished my PhD under Dr. White, and White knew Martin a little bit, and I don't know if Martin ever remembered me or that visit years before, but anyway, he invited me for an interview, and I eventually got the job at Lexington.
And what was the nature of that job?
And I was hired as what they called at the time a staff fellow. And it was in Bill Martin's group. So we were doing neuropharmacology, basically continuing the stuff that I was working on in my PhD, which also was about hallucinogens. It was about tryptamine and electroencephalographic effects in animals of tryptamine, which is what Martin had purported to be an LSD-type hallucinogen. Mm-hmm. And he had done some work in Lexington at the time, or was doing work, where he identified tryptamine in the brain, and he had done some tolerance experiments with LSD, cross tolerance with tryptamine, things like mm-hmm. that. And so he was interested in the same work that I had done for my PhD. And so he invited me up, and our first experiment was to do we did two experiments. We did an evoked potential, a transcolossal evoked potential, where you stimulate one side of the brain and record from the other, and the signal is carried through the corpus callosum, which is a big mm-hmm. neural tract.
Yes.
Should I go into that?
That's okay.
All right.
I got it.
Big neural tract. Anyway, so we had found that since Martin had found fairly high concentrations of corpus of tryptamine in the area of the around the corpus callosum at the end, he's in the cortex of the brain, he thought maybe that would modulate that potential so that we did experiments where we did these transcallosal potentials, and then we gave the animals LSD or tryptamine or mescaline. No, DMT, I think it was. I think it was the other one. LSD type hallucinogens. And it was my first failed experiment. Unfortunately, it wasn't failed, I guess, but it turned out that LSD increased the size of the potential, and tryptamine didn't do much, and I think DMT made it smaller or something like that. Anyway, it didn't look like they were the same kinds of drugs based on those results. But then we did another experiment where we were actually, and this required a lot of surgical technique, but we ended up actually severing the corpus callosum and then trying to measure the levels of tryptamine on each side to see if it built up in the predator, see if it was actually being excellently transported. And so anyway, that's how I started it.
What organism?
We were using a dog, dog, which was one of Martin's favorite, because there had been a stereotaxic atlas for the beagle. It was one of the only dogs that had a stereotaxic instrument developed. And so that's how we ended up using beagles.
Okay. I want to go back just for a second. When you said you were a child of the 60s and you were involved in or around drug use, yes, you said that. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Did you come into contact with users or people you would describe as addicts at that point, or what was your social?
It was like a friends thing. Mm-hmm. People smoking pot. People, social kinds of situations.
Didn't you tell me that you played in a band?
No.
Were you you weren't a musician?
I think you may have misunderstood. I was with a friend of mine was in a band and used to play at RPI.
That's right.
Yeah, so I was over there, but I was never in the band.
That's right. Oh, okay. All right. You don't want to claim credit as a musician. Okay. All right. So now let's go back then to Lexington and what it was like as a research environment. Bill Martin's group, can you describe how it worked? Did people generate? How did research get shaped within that group?
Well, within the very small group, I'm most comfortable talking about that. That would be Martin's group. And that would be Bill Martin was of course at the top, and Jewel Sloan was in the group. Mm-hmm. She was like the chemist kind of person, and I hope I don't leave anybody else. But the other people, Jim Bell, was a neurophysiologist. Bruce Vopel, who was Martin's graduate student at VAUPEL, his graduate student at Kentucky and got his PhD under Martin. There was another guy named Paul Gilbert and Larry Sharp, who I ended up working a lot with, and me. And as I said, I hope I'm not leaving anybody too much out of it. But those were the people. And we all did different things. But generally speaking, at that point, Martin would assign ideas. And, you would help develop with him. But they were generally his ideas, quite frankly. And he made no bones about it. He said, I hired you to work with me. If you want to do your own stuff, you can do it at night or on the weekend or something.
So he's a little autocratic.
It was, very autocratic. Dr. Martin used to say, we're all on the bus together and I'm the driver. And if you don't like it, you can pull a little cord and I'll let you off anywhere you want. So he had that in him, I must say, which could, actually as a junior scientist, it was nice to see somebody else involved with ideas and to be able to witness the process. Mm-hmm. The downside of it is, of course, if you're in an environment like that, you wonder whether you ever get your own ideas or how mm-hmm. those are received and so on. But in any case, Martin would typically give each of us, like Jim Bell was working on the C-fiber reflex, which is like a neurophysiologic indice of pain response. So he would be doing opiate work, but he also did tryptamine and so forth. Paul Gilbert, largely opiates, but he was responsible with Martin for early evidence for multiple opiate receptors.
Yes.
In his paper. And you probably see that.
At what point had Martin I mean, that was sort of Martin's idea.
Yeah, that was one of the main things that he had, yes.
And at what point, had he advanced that before you got there?
Yeah, I think that he wrote an article in Pharmacological Reviews in 67, I want to say, and I didn't get there until probably 74. So, I mean, that idea was on his plate for a long time. I think that's right about that.
So you think 74?
That's when I got there, for sure. I know that. Yeah. Now, I'm not positive of when his review article came out about pharmacology.
Yeah, that I have that. I don't remember.
But Martin had always had an idea about regarding the opiates. Is that, like, I think his first one was the redundancy hypothesis, which was like in after a person is addicted to a drug, that alternative pathways that usually subserve a function that was present in the quote normal brain got subserved by the presence of the opiates, and then other pathways which ordinarily wouldn't participate, other neural pathways, say, which ordinarily wouldn't participate in a response, then became hyperactive because of the subservience of the primary pathway by the drugs of abuse. So then when you take away the drug of abuse, you have this, you have several pathways mediating the response, and that's why the withdrawal phenomena tends to be an exaggerated phenomenon, you know, in opposite direction to the primary drug action.
Okay, and that redundancy hypothesis.
So that even preceded the multiple opiate hypothesis, as far as I could. You might want to check the dates on that, but I believe that's right. Gordetsky and Jasinski could probably give you a little better take on that. About, you know, because basically, I think the introduction of the drug cyclazosine from Rensselaer, as a matter of fact, began people to think about a different, you know, that there must be something else different going on, because it wasn't a pure mu agonist, although they didn't call it that at the time. It was different. And I think that whole series of, I think they're benzomorphans, but those drugs led to the idea that maybe there's several places the opiates are working and not just one receptor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, getting back to the people. So Martin would, basically give everybody different sort of projects that may evolve around a theme that he had in mind, and he had many, many things in mind, not just the tryptamine thing. I mean, obviously he was interested in the opiates, he was interested in social aspects of addiction, and the chemistry. I mean, he was very, very broad-minded.
What form did his interest in the social aspects take?
He hired a woman named Barbara Hewitt, for example, and she was interested she was only with us for a little while, but she was as I recall, a sociologist, and so he was kind of interested in the addict as a person, too, the idea of hypophoria, you know, the psychiatric thing. David Kaye was there, John Griffiths. There was just a whole lot of people. So Martin would hire people that would further his interest in different areas, kind of thing.
So at that point, you really saw him as shaping
he was shaping the whole agenda of that place, as far as I could tell.
Yeah.
I suspect other people would verify.
And what were his relationships like with Isbell and sort of
Wickler?
Wickler, the sort of senior generation?
I only saw him interact with Abe Wickler, and it was always very, very collegial and very deferential. I mean, they liked one another, and they respected each other's efforts and work,
And Martin actually was just not around at all.
No, I mean, he would come down for visits occasionally, but I think he had already left by the time I got there. The people that were left were Frazier was there, kind of at an emeritus status, and Wickler had gone to UK, but Abe Wickler always tried to continue to go out to NIDA to meet, you know, the people at the ARC and to kind of keep up. He gave a class on Saturday mornings at UK. Mostly it was for medical, either a psychiatric residents or what. But anyway, all the people, all the staff fellows that went through the group were encouraged to go to Wickler's Saturday morning class. And Wickler would come to every one of our, virtually all the seminars and mm-hmm. all that stuff. So he had much more of a presence than Isbell.
Mm-hmm. And what about the shadow of Lawrence Kolb and the sort of very old?
Yeah, that I can't really speak to. I mean, I know he was revered, of course, and Himmelsbach and all those people were referred to occasionally. But I didn't get the sense that they had the same, kind of influence over Martin and the lab that Wickler did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and Isbell. Isbell definitely had an influence, because I think Isbell was the person that with Chuck Hartson, developed a lot of these scales about mm-hmm. the Addiction Research Center inventory and the different ways that you could numerically, sort of objectively, quantify subjective effects, mm-hmm. by asking people questions about how they felt or those sorts of things,
yes.
and then to try and put a number on that. And I mean, I guess Himmelsbach was the first one that ever come up with the idea with the Himmelsbach withdrawal scale, but with Hartson and Isbell, they extended it to many other kinds of drugs and drug classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So at that point, those of you who came, was there a cohort? I mean, did you feel like other people came in at the same time you did?
Yeah, they would typically have one or two people come in a year, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot, but it was always a steady little
And did you live there?
In Lexington?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you lived in Lexington, but not at the...
No, not at the center.
Conan describes living there.
Yeah, he may have. At one time, the public health service officers did live on the premises.
Right. But so was there a sort of feeling of, we're off doing this in a sort of frontier kind of way? I mean, how would you describe the relationship of Lexington as a research facility to other places, like Michigan? Or,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how much contact or traffic was there?
It was pretty insular, looking back at it. And I don't think I maybe appreciated it as much at the time as I have since. Because I've talked to other people. Of course, I was very young. I had just gotten out of graduate school. And quite frankly, Tennessee was not the mecca of all the research going on either. So, but Lexington was even more insular, because it was just, it was pretty much Dr. Martin's fiefdom, I guess you would say, out there. And it was excellent research and good research and well-respected stuff, but it was not, we would have seminar speakers come through and people would be invited. I mean, famous people, Costa was there, people like that. I mean, so Martin would get people to come in, but it was not anything like it is now in Baltimore, I can tell you that. It's like totally opposite.
Mm-hmm. And did you see that as an advantage, a disadvantage?
Looking back, I think it was a little bit personally and professionally a bit of a disadvantage. I think it was an advantage for Martin and for maybe for the field, because it was a place that you could really direct research in a certain way. And if you have a leader at the top of that has some good vision, you get a lot done in that situation. The disadvantage, of course, professionally, is you never really separate yourself from Martin. And it's always hard to look at my work or someone else's work and say, well, is this Pickworth or is this Martin that said this? You know what I mean? And so to establish your own identity as a young investigator probably may not be as good as other places.
And at what point would you say that you did that?
I think when I moved to Baltimore.
So that move. Okay, let's start talking about that move, unless there are other... Are there other things I should know about Lexington? I'm interested in Lexington because you get a really different account. You see the insularity. You can see the insularity when you look at the texts and you look at the way that people talk about each other. And you can see the ways in which that was a pretty unique environment. And there's a way in which it was off the beaten path. And so I'm trying to get a sense of how off the beaten path it was and how that worked.
Yeah.
Advantage.
I guess everyone has a different take on it. I came in very early. That was my first job after graduate school, and I came from a graduate school that was not a highlight place, kind of. Not to put down Tennessee, but let's face it, it was just, that was a school that was primarily designed to train physicians and dentists and so forth to serve the people of Tennessee. It's a state university kind of thing. And they had a graduate school, but it was, you know, mostly that graduate school is to support, you know, the efforts of the teaching, really. So someone else might have said, well, God, if I didn't, you know, like people that I knew, actually people I went to college with, went to Vanderbilt to go to graduate school at the same time, and that was already a much, you know, more prestigious, higher level, and, you know, Sutherland was there, they discovered the adenyl cyclase and all that kind of thing. That was going on, and you could see in talking to them that you know, Tennessee was not just at the top of the game, so to speak. So Lexington was, for me, a really good place at first, because it was, you know, like, that was the top of the game mm-hmm. in the addiction field. But it was isolated. I mean, I think that's, I mean, first of all, there was no direct flights. You couldn't go from Lexington anywhere without changing planes, virtually. And so, I mean, even to go to Washington, which even kept it more isolated from the, quote, headquarters, you know, because Martin hardly ever, I mean, nobody from headquarters ever came to Lexington that I could remember. I mean, they would for the 50th anniversary or something like that.
Right.
But there was not, like, the day-to-day thing. Like, in Baltimore, it's not unusual for people to be going down to the headquarters every day.
Yes, right.
So, I mean,
right.
So there was not that. So Martin sort of had it the way, you know, I mean, I guess the way he wanted it, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. Okay, so now let's talk about that move then, when the ARC moved to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Can you sort of describe, that coincides in time with your feeling like you're coming into your own as mm-hmm. a researcher?
Yeah. I think it did. And then part of that is because Martin had already left at that point. He had already finally decided to go to stay in Kentucky and go to the University of Kentucky and take a position there. That put Jasinski and Gordetsky as the lab directors. Mm-hmm. And first it was just Don, and then eventually it became a position that was shared with Don taking the first wave, as it were, to Baltimore.
Right.
And then Chuck Gordetsky staying in Lexington and directing the lab there. And Chuck did just a wonderful job, I must say. It was a hard time, but he actually was one of the people that helped further, you know, that feeling of independence and you know, mm-hmm. for me, personally. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful boss.
And he was several years sort of ahead of you mm-hmm. in terms of his own career
yes.
trajectory.
Right.
Okay. And when you started doing things that you thought of as more on your own, what things did you do, and how did you decide to do them?
A lot of it, of course, is an extension of what you've done in the past. I mean, it's not like you just didn't fall out of the sky or anything. But we had been working with the opiates, and I was supplying the EEG techniques to, like, a drug called clonidine, which had been, at the time, thought to be useful for diminishing opiate withdrawal syndromes. I think Jasinski had that idea, among others. And so I wanted to take that back to the animal lab and look at the effects of clonidine in animals on EEG measures of cortical EEG and sleep measures and so forth. So I began doing those experiments. Larry Sharp and I had begun a series of experiments to look at the pupillary effects of drugs in animals. And we had gotten into some techniques called, like, micro-injections, where we were putting small amounts of drugs right into the oculomotor nucleus, which is the place of the brain that controls pupillary size. And so we began those experiments together. And I guess, you know, it's hard to really say what led me to that. I guess I was led to that by what I'd done before. It's mm-hmm. most of life. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But there was a major break when I moved to Baltimore, and that's when I began doing the clinical stuff. So, but as it turned out, I mean, most of my clinical experience has been very closely drawn to what I was doing in the animal stuff. I've still gotten a lot of publications and consultantships and chapters and so forth about the pupillary effects of drugs and using drugs to index, or using the pupil to index drug effect, to look at pupillary measures of fitness for duty and a lot of applications beyond drug abuse.
Yeah.
So the pupillary stuff came back to the clinical, and so did some of the EEG stuff.
So your story is a little bit different from the way that, say, Art Jacobson wrote a history of CPDD, and he talked about 1976 and that sort of moment when the ARC moves and the loss of the human subjects in Lexington.
Right.
And more as, your work was largely in animal models at Lexington.
Right.
And so your move to humans, I mean, your move to clinical work
yeah.
was actually reversed. It
mm-hmm.
occurred when you moved to Baltimore, not right. it was not going on when you were in Lexington.
Right. The only thing I did with clinical people in Lexington is I worked with Dave Kay on a series of experiments, and actually those data were already pretty much collected, but he was doing sleep studies of and finding out how did opiates affect human sleep, and he had tons of EEG sleep records. And since I was doing EEG, Jasinski thought maybe I could help, I think it was Jasinski, thought maybe mm-hmm. I could help Dave Kay out and also help myself out by getting a little clinical experience by helping him to analyze these records, which meant basically reading.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you've ever done it, there are about 1,000 pages for each night, for each subject. I mean, the paper is this high. And, you know, you just go through and all this is stage 3 sleep, stage 4 sleep, REM sleep, you know, and you make judgments and then you figure quantitatively how much is it here, how much is it there. It's maddening. But I did get to read those sleep records quick. Because he had a room full of them.
And what did you get out of those studies? I mean,
that was interesting. You know, one of the drugs that actually there were 3 or 4 publications that came out of it, and it described the fact that opiates, both during their acute administration and during withdrawal, affect human sleep in particular ways, namely diminishing REM sleep, and you know, so we did get some very good quantified sleep measures out of it. And one of the interesting things was, is one of the drugs that Dave Kay studied and had records on was cyclasazine, and it was one of the things we realized is that cyclasazine, the people were the sleep was disrupted, but the other thing we realized that many of them had a pee during the night that caused urination.
Huh.
And that became a very classic. And then we went back in the literature and realized that other people had noticed that the kappa opiate drugs, of which cyclasazine is one, tends to increase urination. And then others have found that the mechanisms related to ADH release and so on. But it was interesting that eventually then, in fact, just a few years ago, Kenzie Preston and I were looking at cyclasazine again, and we cited all that literature about, you know, the doses we'd given and using the urination as an index of kappa activity.
Yeah, so this is, you still go back to that literature.
Sure, it's amazing, isn't it? I guess when you start doing the same studies, when it starts coming around twice, you know it's time to retire now. Because who would ever thought, you know, 20 years later, I would still be citing stuff that I did, you know, at the time, thinking about it as trying to distinguish the effects of mu versus kappa drugs on human sleep, and then years later looking at it that the same kappa drug is an antagonist to cocaine or something. I mean, you know,
yes.
It's just strange.
Yes. Yes. So how would you currently characterize your research priorities? I mean, as you let's see. We're still back in that transition.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the story of how your research changed from that point into the present. I mean, how?
Right. Well, I think Jerry Jaffe was the director. When we moved to Baltimore, when the second wave moved to Baltimore, Jaffe took over as the director. You know, Jasinski was going to be the branch chief for the clinical pharmacology branch. Gordetsky had decided to go to industry at that point, soon after that anyway. And then Jaffe was going to be the overall director of the lab. And Jerry changed the lot of the structure was. And to be fair, I mean, I must say, I don't know how he came up with this, but I think it was more of a necessity than anything else. But Jasinski and Jack Henningfield, but particularly Jasinski, wanted to build a clinical EEG or electrophysiology unit. Scott Lucas, who's another person you might want to talk to, actually, he was never in Lexington, but he was in the Baltimore group working with Jasinski and doing EEG effects of drugs. in humans. And he had left to go to Harvard. And so Jasinski wanted to build that up. And so he hired Ron Herning, who's still there in Baltimore. And to help Ron Herning out, they asked me to go over and work with Herning in this clinical EEG kind of thing. And Ron had quite a bit of experience in clinical EEG. He came from San Francisco. And so they thought, well, you know, my experience with EEG was largely in animals, but with that stuff at the sleep study. So anyway, that's how, I guess, how Jaffe came to put me into the clinical group under Jasinski at the time. And then, but as soon as, when Jasinski left, then Jack Henningfield took that over. And at that time, you know, Jack had a big interest in tobacco dependence that he and Don had started working with. And so he continued that on and then asked Ron and I to apply the EEG measures to tobacco and nicotine dependence and withdrawal and that sort of thing. And that's kind of how it crystallized.
Right, so you ended up making a real move into nicotine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, nicotine was kind of an underappreciated addictive drug at the time. And Jack had, you know, with some early studies with IV nicotine had in people, and these people had experience with cocaine, and they said, gee, this stuff feels like cocaine to a certain extent. They answered these ARCI questions like it was a stimulant. And then the withdrawal thing came out, and so, yeah. And that's really the commitment I have now. So those are my two major research focuses. Still, I'm interested in the pupil and pupillometry and tobacco dependence.
And would you say that your research trajectory, was it consonant or dissonant with what NIDA prioritized?
I think it was, you know, the work with the tryptamine stuff, I don't really know if NIDA had that as one of their priorities, the hallucinogen stuff. So I guess that was a little dissonant, but of course it was very consonant with Martin's view of the world. Since he was my boss, I guess that was consonant. But, and the nicotine field has been, in my opinion, with NIDA, a little bit, at first a little underserved, but now generally recognized to be one of their priorities. So,
what do you think changed that?
I think Leshner had something to do with that. I think I give a lot of that to Jay Turkan. She was the person that worked in Turkan, T-U-R-K-A-N. She's left NIDA, but she was with when Leshner was down in Rockville. She was like the nicotine liaison person, and I think she really brought to Alan the idea that NIDA should have more interest in nicotine. And of course, Nora Volkow is very interested in nicotine and tobacco dependence. In the early parts of the nicotine studies, it was always kind of hard to say whether NIDA was that interested in it or not. I mean, for a long time, maybe tobacco was thought of just being a bad habit or something like that, not even an addictive drug. So we sort of missed it early on, I must say, as everyone else did, I guess. But
and why do you think it was?
It's a good question. Why is that?
I mean, was it because it was? It must have been pretty ubiquitous.
Oh, it was. Right. And, I mean, at that time, you know, and I remember my first day in Lexington, one of the first things they gave me was an ashtray. You could have it at your desk. I mean, you could give me an idea. It came with the waste barrel and the pencil sharpener. I mean, that was just standard equipment. People smoked in their office, smoked in the lab, I mean, and, you know.
I assume that they were allowed, that prisoners were allowed.
I believe so, although I'm not positive. Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody was smoking. But Jack Henningfield and Don really raised that issue. It's like, what happens when you stop? Or how does he think it's just a bad habit? We'll try to stop for a couple of days, see what happens. No, we can't, really.
So you think that interest of theirs came out of just, you know, that kind of observation, that kind of everyday observation?
I don't really know that, because Jack had a lot of history at Minnesota with Travis Thompson in behavioral pharmacology, and he may have had other. He's a person you might want to talk to, yeah. Actually. He's at the meeting, Jack Henningfield. Because mm-hmm. he was in Baltimore. He was never in Lexington either, but he came from Hopkins to the to work with Jasinski.
Right, so he was there during that transitional moment.
Yes, right.
Okay, what about the relationship between, you call it headquarters.
Right.
And the ARC. I detect that that relationship has changed over time, but that the ARC was always a little bit, what? I don't know. I don't know how I would describe the relationship. Can you tell me what it was like? I mean, was there tension between the ARC and the rest of NIDA once it was NIDA?
Well, when I got there, it was NIDA. I mean, I think that was the first year that was actually NIDA. Mm-hmm. And so I really can't speak to what was happening before. But I can tell you, in the very early years when we were in Lexington, this is obviously, it was my first year, and I was kind of lost in terms of the administrative structure, what was going on. But I didn't really get that. I thought that the people at the, quote, NIDA headquarters, the people like Bob DuPont and early people like that, I think they had a lot of respect for what was going on at Lexington. They had a lot of respect for Martin personally and for Wickler and for other people that had gone through that program. And Kars Besteman, and I sort of know these names, but I don't really know the people very well. But I always got the impression that they had good years that either they had been at Lexington themselves or had good experiences with people that had been there. And they were quite supportive mm-hmm. early on. Mm-hmm. Of course, as the old guard, I think, kind of wash out, I think that then the... then perhaps there wasn't as much support later on, mm-hmm. but I don't, you know, that I'm saying, you know, I was never really in a position when I was there to like make judgments about mm-hmm. the administrative kind of ambience, as it were. After we moved to Baltimore, I can tell you it became much more clear that we were definitely a part of a larger organization, and we weren't just like a cousin or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there, so that there was like frequent visits from the directors, more people from Baltimore going to Rockville than people from Rockville coming to Baltimore. But there was clearly an interaction. We would be on working groups together. There would be telecommunications. And it was definitely a much closer relationship.
Did that change the nature of the research or the decisions, the process by which you decided what to work on?
Hard to say, I think, because at the same time that that happened, of course, there was a new administration as Jaffe was taken over, and it wasn't Martin any or Jasinski, right? It's the old school, and it was Jaffe, who actually had training at Lexington, but, you know, had been other places prior
yes.
to coming back. So, And to be fair, one of the things Jerry did is he had a much more psychiatric view. I mean, he had also had a wide range of views, but I think he began to look at the genetics thing. He began to look at a lot of different views that Martin didn't seem to be embracing. I mean, mm-hmm. not to say that Bill Martin didn't have these views. I mean, but
I was going to ask you whether genetics ever came up before.
No, not when we were. I don't remember it ever coming up in Lexington.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it may have been mentioned or something, but never as a research agenda item kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Jerry saw that, I think Jerry Jaffe saw some of that, and he definitely had a much more social view, I think, you know, looking at treatment programs and in fact we started a treatment branch under him. He had an epidemiological point of view. There wasn't much of that in Lexington, really. So Jerry actually extended the agenda quite widely.
Mm-hmm. The return, I'm interested in what the status of psychiatry was, or clearly for somebody like Lawrence Kalb, their psychopathology was a big, you know, you weren't addicted if you were normal. Mm-hmm. You had to have a psychopathology underlying in order to become addicted. That view clearly was questioned by Wickler, et cetera, right? I mean, there was a... So what can you tell me something about the cycle through which psychiatry went as an explanatory framework during the years that you've watched the field?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, yeah, Wickler... Well, I think that, you know, drug addiction itself has always been kind of sort of shifted in the medical literature. I think that in general, in psychiatry, some people would argue has as well.
Yeah.
And so we're a very poor cousin of underappreciated discipline, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But because they're sick people and you know, they've gotten there through, you know, their own social deviance.
Right.
And character flaws and all these other sort of things that are used to explain. I think Wickler made it clear that anybody could get addicted, and Wickler and many others. I mean, you know, given the circumstances, you could take the drug long enough. And now with the appreciation of tobacco dependence, we see that with a lot of normal people
right.
that are addicted, and
right.
they'll tell you their addiction if you ask them. So, I think that's now becoming a general, you know, generally accepted that. You know, even caffeine dependence is now becoming recognized, for example.
Yeah.
And people can't do without it, and it's not anything to do with their character or anything mm-hmm. like that. But it's been a long time before people have been able to accept that notion.
Yes.
And some of the stuff we've done, I guess, or some of the stuff that's been done by people in this college and elsewhere, if you know, shown that under certain circumstances, anybody can get addicted to almost anything. I mean, any of these psychotropic drugs are reinforcing. Martin did have a view at one time, his so-called, what did he call it? Hypophoria. He thought addicts were hypophoric, I guess is the way you described
right.
it. He said that they weren't depressed, like in clinical depression, but they didn't get the same joys out of life that other
yes.
people do, and therefore they looked toward drugs to replace that, what they couldn't ordinarily experience. And that was one of the things he worked on actually with Barbara Hewitt. That was one of the things she did.
Was try to figure that.
Well, I think they did mostly like scales and trying to figure out how that all came about.
Yeah. Let's return to addiction being short shrifted in the medical literature. Do you think that poor cousin sort of idea is because of the association with addicts? Because of the sort of social, because they occupy a socially subordinate status, that the field, that the profession would somehow be subordinate in some way because of its association with addicts?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that, you know, there's no advocacy for addicts in general.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a general disassociation, I think, between, you know, addiction to alcohol, which seems to have, for a long time, had better, I think, social status than addiction to opiates, for example. But it's interesting, I guess, and when you think that, you know, the fields of medicine and the support, the social support, the sympathy, if you will, is determined a lot by the nature of people that are afflicted.
Yeah. Do you know David Courtwright's work?
Yes, some of it. Uh-huh.
One of his main points has been to show that drug policy is similar, that how we approach addiction from the sort of policy end depends upon who is addicted, right? Who we perceive as the main addicted population at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are shifts in drug policy when there are shifts in the population and the drug of choice. In some ways, I'd like to be able to show that with the field of addiction research, because I do think it's interesting. And your own work in tobacco, it's an interesting move, because suddenly, as you say, all these clearly normal folks mm-hmm. are addicted and will admit that they're addicted. And so there's been a change in how we use that word and how we think about it. What have you made of the sort of change in terminology over, I mean, clearly you've witnessed a, you know, an attempt to get it to be called dependency, or drug dependence, the new emergence of it as a chronic relapsing brain disorder, right? Yeah. You've seen those shifts. What have you made of those? Are you still studying the same phenomenon, no matter what you call it, or?
I think so, you know, but I think it does reflect a little bit of how you look at it. In other words, if you call it a chronic relapsing brain disorder, you think of it as something you would study using approaches of neuroscience and of genetics and of that sort of thing. Whereas if you call the same phenomena an addiction, you might look at it more as a, you know, like something you would treat with behavioral therapy or cognitive therapy or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that you know, what you call something doesn't change the identity of what you're describing, but definitely it changes the perception and how it's approached. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that with the addictive disorders now.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example?
Well, tobacco, caffeine. Mm-hmm. I think it's the beginning. It's one of the ones that's beginning to start. So in 1954, whatever it was, when 50% of the adult population smoked, you know, and no one thought it was an addiction at the time. And now we find people struggling to stop. When you interview smokers, 70% say they want to quit, and 10% or 20% of them try each year to quit. I mean, of all smokers, but only 2 or 3% are successful without any kind of therapy. So, you know, clearly. And then when you ask them, are you addicted, most of them say, yeah. I mean, they'll score 4 to 5 on a 5-point scale. Mm-hmm. So the smoker themselves is beginning to accept that. It's too bad we don't have that data from 1954 to see whether or not they said they were addicted then.
Right.
I mean, that would be a very, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there, that data are around. I would like to see that, to see. So therefore, there's a disease or a phenomenon that's now defined as an addiction, and its users define themselves as addicts, if you will. But when in 1954, when it was more defined as a social choice, even a choice is what the tobacco companies used to say,
yes.
I mean, or at least, or a habit or whatever, down to people call themselves addicted then? I don't know.
Probably not.
I think so. The parlance of the language, it does, as David quite right is written about, as you're saying.
Yes.
Determine not only how society looks at the phenomena, but also how its own users view it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Given that, you have a pretty... You've been interested in popular representations. You do this thing with the journalists, right?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do with this kind of popular education?
That was, I must say, that's something I've just gotten into lately, and it's not like a drive I've ever had. Bob Schuster, when he was the CPDD direct president, asked me to take over the media committee to be the chair of it. And so I thought, well, you know, and I had been on the media committee for a few years, and we didn't do anything to speak. I mean, well, don't put that in.
No.
It was just like, oh, we put out a press release for the meeting or something like that, you know, and I thought, well, we ought to be able to do something better than that. And so we've tried to increase the visibility of the college and the field by, you know, doing the media award. As a matter of fact, David Cartwright won it 2 years ago.
Yes.
by identifying people that use the popular press and media to promote the views of the college by giving an informed decision about, you know, drug abuse, its consequences, treatment, so forth. So we started the media. I think we got the media award back on track. We've named some really good people, and it's now become an annual award, and I think it's a good award. Brings visibility to people that use that information also to the college. And then I started this thing with Bob Bolster where we make press releases about articles that come out in drug and alcohol dependence. Oh. So I'll draft up a press release or Stollerman will identify an article that's in press. They've already accepted it. They'll contact the author and say, do you mind if I share this with the media committee? And with the purpose of generating press about your article as it appears in the journal.
So these are scientific articles.
Scientific articles.
That you think are...
that bolster things, and I think are kind of importance from a popular point of view. Like, mm-hmm. What do they say about what our studies mean to people, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yes.
So then I develop a press release, just a page or something like that. Some of it is quite frankly, designed to increase the visibility of the journal, mm-hmm. and also the increase the visibility of the author. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little paragraph at the end of each one, about the college, it's old, it's around, there's a lot of people in it, that kind of thing. And then there's a description of what the article is about and what it means. So we started doing that, and we bring the journalists now to the meeting, and every year there's 14 or 15 of them that come from this program at Wake Forest. Mike Kuhar actually was the one that identified that, but he's on the media committee, and he has done that with us for the last several years, so that's helped. We still do the press release for the meetings and send it out to the popular press to try and get people, it's a little bit of media coverage for the meeting. Mm-hmm.
But it's mainly CPGD. It's not, but you see it as contributing to the field itself.
Yeah, I do see it as. I think it's important, and as I say, I've actually extended my term for a couple times because I want to see it continue. In fact, at one time, I even thought personally maybe going into this after I leave, I had to do some press relations and so forth. That I could see that as a bit. I don't think I'm going to do it because I don't really have any training in the field other than what I've taught myself.
Right.
But there are a lot of scientific organizations, small ones, that would like that but don't know how to really go about it. So with my experience, I thought, well, maybe I could do that.
So that you might do the consulting.
No, I was thought at one time I would do it. I don't think I'm going to pursue that, really. Yeah. I think because there's a lot of people in that whole field of media relations. I mean, there's people with degrees. It's pretty competitive.
What about NIDA's efforts to kind of educate the public? How do you view those?
I think they're trying. I think they have a lot of, they put a lot of energy, a lot of money into that. Tim Condon, you might want to talk to mm-hmm. him. He's in the, there's a whole public policy kind of division, I think.
I interviewed Cindy Miner.
Yes, that's right. That's another person, they have a website they maintain. They put out all manner of publications for teachers and for kids, the postcards. I mean, mm-hmm. NIDA puts a lot of money into that. Yeah.
How would you evaluate those efforts?
Well, I never have evaluated, but there is an article, and I think it's just about to come out in Drug and Alcohol Dependence, come to say. In fact, we wrote a press release about it. And it was, where do people get information about ecstasy, I think. And so they interviewed, and, for whatever. And I can't remember who wrote the article, I'll be honest with you. But nevertheless, basically the bottom line was, when they asked people where they get their information about drug use and their decisions to use drugs and so forth, basically it's not NIDA, it's still their friends, number one. To a certain extent, the popular literature, like what they're reading, further down the line is the physician, the parents, and then finally comes NIDA. I think we were dead last, as a matter of fact, in the website. So we obviously there's need for improvement. I suspect if you ask any teenager how they get any information about anything, whether it's drug use or almost anything, it's probably the same order.
Yes.
What
about physicians? Have you felt that physicians know enough, get enough training around addiction?
Excuse me. No, my feeling is not, but I think that the medical school curriculum is probably so crammed in right now that it's mm-hmm. probably just difficult to get everything. But I think that, I don't think they get enough, quite frankly. And I don't know if NIDA has a particular agenda to reach out to medical school training right now.
Yeah, there seem to be particular places where it's done and not elsewhere. I wanted to go, one thing that I skipped was asking about your role in pharmacotherapy and whether have you had any role in the nicotine patch or any of that? The reason I asked the medical school question was because I realized that there are all these trainings now on buprenorphine, where teams of physicians are being trained to prescribe it, mm-hmm. and then studied to see whether they do prescribe it more, et cetera.
That's Ed Johnson is definitely the person mm-hmm. to talk to about that, because he works for Rickett Brinkman, who's the people that manufacture that.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot of studies with buprenorphine. Yeah, that's one of his main things right now.
Okay.
But you're right. I mean, it looks like it's becoming, in the case of buprenorphine, a commercial enterprise. In other words, the drug company has a drug. In order for them to get the message out, they really have to do the education. I mean, that's not unusual for drug companies to do. I mean, but in this particular one, this looks like even more kind of fundamental. They're going to teach you about addiction as well as how to use the drug to treat it. Mm-hmm. And there's special licensing and all that sort of stuff that I know a little bit about, but Ed's definitely the person to ask about
that.
But I think that NIDA does need, I don't know if they need to do that or not, but that's clearly something they don't do much of, I don't think, is to mm-hmm. try and educate the professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do have treatment guidelines for certain things, and those sort of things come out, but this day-to-day treatment about, AIDS and drug abuse probably could be more.
Right, but your own work hasn't been that concerned with treatment?
Well, the nicotine has. I've done studies with the nicotine patch, the nicotine gum.
So evaluating it or developing it?
We don't typically have mostly looking at, for example, seeing whether the nicotine patch prevents performance decrements associated with tobacco withdrawal. So they're small sample studies. They're not like clinical trials. Yeah. I have been involved in some of those, but for the most part, NIDA has not been a particularly good place to do clinical trial work. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that big of a patient population. The patients we deal with are largely healthy people, so if you're... presumably we could do tobacco cessation studies. In fact, Eric Mulchan just finished one in adolescents comparing the patch, gum, and behavioral therapy in kids, and I worked on that study. Mm-hmm. But there's not too much of that done, quite frankly, there.
So who is doing that?
Those are done by, like, private companies universities, people at universities that have a big history of doing clinical trial sort of stuff.
Okay. And have you, over time, watched the evolution of whenever you talk about drugs, there's obviously a pharmaceutical industry, and there's sort of cross traffic between industry, academia, and government, mm-hmm. for want of a better word. What have those relationships been like? How have they changed over time during the period you've been involved?
I think the main thing I think that NIDA has a big medications development initiative to find treatments for cocaine dependence and traditionally for opiate dependence. And they're working very, very hard on those things. I don't think that NIDA has put a lot of money into the tobacco dependence field, mainly because I think that that there's so many smokers that want to quit smoking, that there's, and the drugs that are out there have been commercially very successful. I think that generally the feeling is that why should the government be supporting the development of drugs for which there is a big commercial interest? The drug companies should do this and they make a profit doing mm-hmm. that. On the other hand, for drugs like cocaine and opiates, there's probably not a whole lot of commercial potential. Quite frankly, the people that are addicted are not those that are going to be able to pay a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And therefore the drug companies are not going to do that. That's not part of their agenda. And therefore, NIDA should probably put their money in drug development into finding treatments for those sorts of disorders. I think that's generally been the feeling. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I mean, that we still do work, as I mentioned, with the nicotine gum and the patch, but they're not like discovery kind of things. They're using those as tools to better describe a disease or to mm-hmm. find out a mechanism, things like that.
Yes.
So that's how it sort of impacted me.
Right.
I have been involved in early studies with LAM, which, for example, is one of the drugs they use for opiate dependence.
Yes.
And I've been involved with buprenorphine studies early on, and not clinical trials, but I mean, you know, using the small groups of volunteers to do pharmacokinetics or to do acute effects or assess the ability to use it on a daily basis versus an every other day or every third day, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of studies I've been involved with, the development of those drugs.
And would you say, what proportion of development did NIDA play in LAM?
I think they were really important.
Yeah, it seems like
they kept it going when everybody else was ready to bag it, basically.
Yes.
And the same thing with buprenorphine. I mean, Rick and Coleman has been, you know, they have a commercial interest in that drug, and have always kept that. It was Rick and Coleman, and I think it's Rick and Greg Berkman.
Actually, Charles Gorodetsky's papers, I think after talking with you.
He told me that. I ran into Chuck later on. She went and dug through my garage or someplace. Yeah.
And there was interesting correspondence there about buprenorphine and about the feeling that maybe folks should have a role, play a role in the commercial development of that drug.
Hmm.
And so it was sort of, I think, the first time that conversation had arisen. I mean, the kind of memos that I was seeing, it looked like, we're trying to work this out. What's this relationship? It could take this form where we have no role and it's just a commercial product that's right. being developed. And then there's this other relationship that's more like what we want, where we do play some role. So I don't actually know what to make of that.
Yeah, I think that it's still being, you know, formed. I mean, I think that you can probably look at that with a lot of stuff that NIH does. I mean, they're kind of at this interesting junction because they use public funding to do science that may end up having commercial importance. And so what do you do? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I think that we're still struggling with that.
Yes.
But as I say, I think the agenda, at least at NIDA, was that they were definitely more interested in seeing development. If they were going to do a medication development division, which they have, and Frank Vacci is a guy that's here and definitely could tell you a lot about that.
Right.
And he would be a good person to talk to. He's a good storyteller. V-O-C-C-I.
Yeah.
NIDA, is going to put their money into drugs that won't be developed by a drug company for like cocaine or opiate dependence, that sort of thing. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, right. Okay, so one more question about ethical issues. You may have watched them change over time. I don't know what the conversation around ethical issues around human subjects and that sort of thing is like at Lexington. Apparently there was some. I mean, another thing I found in Gorodetsky's papers were protocols, and there was a nascent form of informed consent. There was clearly an awareness that you're dealing with human subjects. Could you sort of describe, I guess, and characterize the most significant ethical issues that you've dealt with in your career so that we can sort of ascertain what kind of change there's been in the ethical climate and the sort of awareness of a researcher such as...
Right. Because my clinical research experience has only gone over the last 20 years, so which is not nearly as long a history as you might see.
Yeah.
But even with that, and I'll just speak to what my experiences was, since I really don't know the issues with the prisoners and all that.
Right,
Chuck and Don.
Don definitely. Talked a fair amount, about that.
But when we moved to Baltimore, I mean, when we do clinical experiments, we did the informed consent. We put in a research protocol that was judged by an institutional review board. The character of that has changed. Let's start with that. The institutional review board. When we first moved to Baltimore, it was submitted to a, quote, Hopkins Bayview. Now, that was an institutional review board that served the entire campus. So... But now NIDA has their own institutional review board. It's different from the Hopkins one. So that's been a... And so now the composition of that board and a lot of the administrative structure, the protocols, the requirements, and so forth, follow an NIH model more than than a local model.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's become quite, well, I mean, I think everyone will tell you, it's pretty tedious.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pulling out Jack Henningfield wanted to know about a study that he and I had written up when I first got there, a protocol. And so I wrote it, and I finally dragged it out of the archives just to look what the protocol. I mean, the protocol was like 8 pages long at the max. And now a typical protocol might be 20, 30 pages long. A consent form, which used to be a page or two, could now be several pages.
Yeah.
So it's gotten to be a lot more rigorous, I can tell you that. And but probably anybody could tell you that,
right.
I would guess. I think that, you know, at the heart of it, I mean, I think that there's definitely a need to give people informed consent. I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of it, I think, that I don't know if it's not too well appreciated, is that by trying to protect people and by trying to give them so much information, sometimes you wonder, by making the procedure so onerous, does it end up being that you're keeping drugs off the market, you're impeding research, that you're making people that would be ordinarily try to go to these fields less attracted to them. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
So the ultimate result of society might end up being that you end up impeding the development of therapy because of this process. So I think that there has to be, I mean, I definitely think there needs to be informed consent.
Yeah.
People need to know what they're getting into and the risks and benefits and all this sort of thing. But for the larger scientific and social goals might be impeded by it in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I think that a lot of this is because the informed consent procedure that we deal with is made to be of like the same informed consent procedure that's dealt with by people that have illness. And I think most of our research is on healthy subjects that have already used the drugs we're going to give them and have already experienced what we're going to do, and we just want to do it in a laboratory environment,
right,
largely. So we never, for example, give a drug to a person that hadn't taken it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to demonstrate that. They have to tell us they did. They have to provide positive urines that they did. There's all these sort of things. So if we're going to give benzodiazepines to somebody, we know they've already taken them. So we're just giving them in a controlled environment. And so the informed consent, I mean, it has to talk about all the things that benzodiazepines can do and so on and so forth.
Yes.
But that's taken from the literature. Well, say you got a person and you're looking at a drug for a heart condition. Now, there's other drugs they can, first of all, they're sick. They may be driven to research for different motivations. The drug, there's alternatives to their participation. In other words, they can take other drugs or do surgery or do something different, so they don't have to. I mean, and yet we have to answer to all that in our consent form. So it ends up being kind of ridiculous. You know, your alternative is that, well, you don't have to participate. Whereas the alternative to consent for the patient is you can take this drug or this therapy or this treatment or surgery or whatever. Which have proven benefits. So they're kind of forcing into the model of what we're doing, the model of what a physician is doing to a sick patient. And sometimes they don't fit too well.
Right. Yeah. That's a very good point. I think, I don't remember why I know this, but I think that at Lexington there was that we only give drugs to people who've already used this kind of drug.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was that.
I think there was, too.
That's a very good point. Thanks. Okay. What do you think? I guess we'll close with what you think the most promising research areas are today. I mean, as you contemplate retirement,
yes.
How would you advise people who are entering this field? What would you advise them to pursue and how?
Well, it's still wide open. There's still lots and lots to learn. So I think that there's a lot of answers. I think that personally what I'm being more and more attracted to and is the idea of the pharmacotherapy, of being able to identify through genetics or through markers you know, the people metabolize drugs differently, they use them, they have different receptor systems.
Pharmacogenetics.
Yes, pharmacogenetics. And I think that that is a little bit understudied, but I think that that's going to become a very important part of
why do you suppose it has been understudied?
I think it's because, first of all, the techniques for the genetics and the proteomics and so forth are just coming into, it's not easy to do that on a doctor's visit kind of thing. I mean, it requires quite a bit of, handling of sampling and fairly sophisticated laboratory analysis to get to where you want to be. So there's that, this is the issue of that. I think the other thing is that we don't really know exactly the importance of the different, say, polymorphs of one particular gene or the alleles of it and so forth, and how that's going to change. So I think there's just a lot to be done.
Mm-hmm. Will NIDA do it?
I think NIDA will help do that. Yes, I think they do have an interest in that. I think a lot of institutes will be doing it. I think this is an area where, at least so far, drug companies have not been particularly interested in doing this, is my sense of that they want to sell the drug to everybody, not just the people with a particular allele or a polymorph of one gene that may only have, maybe only 50% of the population or less have it. It would be much better for them to sell to everybody. The ones that doesn't work on, well, they can try something else, I guess. So we've approached some drug companies with the idea of doing this sort of thing to try.
You have. And,
yes.
You guys.
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. And it's not a warmly received idea. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing it themselves, and I'd be a little reluctant to give up that kind of information as to who I was talking about.
No, I'm not going to ask you.
Okay. But
I'm interested in this because I have this other research project on pharmacogenetics, and mm-hmm. I've been curious about it. It hasn't seemed that NIDA has done that much with it yet, mm-hmm. and I've been curious about the potential, and
right.
So I'm glad to hear you mention it as your
We're doing some studies now with the drug, we're measuring the amount of NUR1. This is a controlling gene for dopamine. In other words, the amount of dopamine.
NUR1.
And it's been shown in animal studies, if you give animals lots of drugs, they overexpress. And it's not only are these genes present, it's also how much of them are there. And, you can change the presence of the amount of a gene by the environment, by stress, and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So we're trying to find out whether this gene is overexpressed or underexpressed in people in drug treatment, and we're using it as controls, non-drug users, and people that just smoke, but don't use drugs, things like that. But that also could become a marker then. Eventually we'll be able to find better peripheral markers of drug use and recency of use, and I think that'll be of importance to verify the effectiveness of treatment or prevention, those sort of things. I mean, you give you a biochemical marker of exposure rather than just...
Yes, I've heard that idea that you could better tailor treatment mm-hmm. if you knew the genetic mm-hmm. profile of the individual in treatment. It's that kind of thing, right?
Yes.
Okay. So when you said you were attracted to pharmacotherapy, you immediately brought up pharmacogenetics rather than the old, the sort of LAM, buprenorphine, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You differentiate between the two. You see promise in one area more so than in the other?
Well, no. I mean, I think you said you find as though it was new, it was coming up. And I think the just talking to people, and this isn't based on my research, but on my experience, I guess, is that, we've tried a lot of drugs that block the effects of these mm-hmm. drugs. We've tried opiate antagonists, and we've tried dopamine antagonists that will inhibit the effects of cocaine and so on. But we know that those do not seem to be very promising therapies, quite frankly. Either people mm-hmm. don't take them, they don't take them because of their side effects, they don't take them because they want to take other drugs, and they know that they're sure of the effect. I mean, it's like antabuse for alcohol.
Yeah.
For a very small percentage of people, it may work, but for the most part, that is not really a way to go. So I think that the new way to look at, another way to look at mm-hmm. pharmacotherapy for the addictive disorders is to try and find drugs that change the way people respond to cues that make them want to take drugs, for example, like drugs that may somehow subtly alter memory for drug experiences, or the positive, you know what I mean? I think that that's kind of, it seems like a hard thing to do, quite frankly. I mean, how do you selectively change memory for drug experience without changing memory for every other experience you've ever had? I mean, I don't know. But, but I mean, I think that there is beginning to get an appreciation that, you know, that just blocking the effect of the drug is not going to change the people's willingness to use the drug.
Have you seen that movie about... It's just come out. I've just seen it. This is terrible.
It's not dopamine.
No, where they actually... No, they change memories. They wipe memories. And... I'll have to
Is it Payday or Payback?
No. It's a very long. The reason I can't remember it is The Spotless Mind is in it. It's a very lengthy movie title.
No.
And it's about The Spotless Mind is in it, and it's essentially this to change memories to completely selectively change memories of a bad relationship.
Oh.
And as I was seeing it, of course it, you know. When you're a historian of the drug sciences, you can't help but think, oh well, this would be an interesting technique.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. So anyway, Hollywood's onto it. That's good.
Yeah. No, it would be a great entertainment at CPDD. This movie.
Definitely.
Okay. Well. That was wonderful. Thank you very much. Anything else I should have asked that I didn't? Or
I'll let you know. I think you're very comprehensive, as always, Nancy.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I hope.